Hello and welcome to the Full of Beans podcast, hosted by myself, Hannah Hickenbotham. Throughout these podcast episodes, we will speak to a range of individuals about their experience of eating disorders, with the aim of increasing awareness and understanding whilst reducing stigma and isolation. Please note that the topics discussed in this podcast may be triggering for some individuals, so tread lightly, check in with yourself, and reflect on these conversations. In this week's episode, I had the pleasure of being joined by food freedom coach Sabrina Mannion. This discussion was so empowering and I think such an important conversation to have because nowadays the normalisation of so many disordered eating behaviours are, as I've just said, so normal, and it leads us to believe that we have to engage in them in order to be accepted in society because of the external factors that we believe should define us. This was such a brilliant conversation and I hope that you're as inspired as me to stand up against all the diet culture bollocks and be free.
Hello!
I literally chose the worst moment possible to take a sip of water.
I got you mid-sip.
You literally, it's like when you're at a restaurant and then you're mid-mouth and they come over and they're like, how's your food? And you're like, Hello, how nice to see you.
Yes, it's so nice to see you too. How are you?
Yeah, not bad, thank you. I've had a pretty good productive day for like the past few weeks have been a bit like, I've just been ill and not really had the energy, but today has been the first day I'm like, no, I've got a lot of work done, which is good.
Oh my god, I'm like the opposite. I am currently suffering through my period, so I'm like, I've got a heat blanket on my uterus right now, but I'm honestly I'm good. It's just, you know, when it feels like someone is stabbing you in the stomach, that's the only thing.
No. It's horrible, isn't it? I feel like with your period, you have the pains, or you have like the mood changes, then you have the pain, then you have like a week of like, oh my god, I'm a woman again, and then you're back to the mood changes, and it's just constant.
You've got like a few days of like, wow, it feels, this is what it feels like to feel good.
This is what it's like to be happy.
Yeah.
So lovely to have you on the podcast, Sabrina. Do you want to, just for the listeners, kind of introduce yourself and let us know what it is that you're passionate about talking about today?
Yeah, absolutely. So I am Sabrina Mannion and I'm a food freedom and intuitive eating coach, and I help women reconnect to their bodies, heal their relationship with food, and develop sustainable, healthy habits that they can stick to for the long term instead of the extremists that we see inside of diet culture.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And I don't know whether it's just me, but at the moment it feels like there's a lot of, it feels like it's like continuously getting worse. And even though there's people like yourself that are doing such brilliant work, it's like the more that we do, the more it's like, no, boom, here's another thing that we're going to throw at you that you absolutely need to try.
Diet culture is always morphing. It's always finding a new way to rebrand and remarket, because we know that it's a booming industry and it is built off of making profit from people's vulnerabilities and people's body image issues. And so they're constantly finding new ways to market to them, and I'm happy to see that the intuitive eating food freedom world is becoming louder and there is more space for that, but I definitely still think that we are very outnumbered.
Which is why it's amazing to have people like yourself fighting back towards the diet culture. And I guess just to start with, how did you first get into being a food freedom coach?
Yeah, I'll try to give you the Sparks Notes version, but as many of us have, I struggled with my own issues when it came to disordered eating, body image, exercise addiction, and then eventually orthorexia. And so it started for me when I was a young girl. I grew up as a synchronized swimmer. So if you're not familiar with the sport, it's a sport where you're in a bathing suit all day long. And it is very highly focused on body image, similarly to ballet and gymnastics. And so you're used to seeing these long, skinny legs and tall women. And you will either make a team or not based on your body type. And so from a very young age, I didn't realize it at the time, but I had all of these ideas of what a right body was. And I never really struggled with my own body image during that time because I was training 25 hours a week. And so it wasn't really hard for me to maintain that very small body. But when I retired from the sport at 16 years old, that's when my issues started creeping in, because I was no longer training 25 hours a week and my body started growing into my adult body. So I started getting hips and I started getting curves and a butt. And my initial programmed reaction was, I'm doing something wrong. I must be eating too much. I must be eating the wrong things, because diet culture tells you that your body is not supposed to change and that there's one right ideal body to have. And I was not big by any mean at the time, but in my opinion, there was something wrong with my body. So I did what anyone else would do, which is I went online and I started looking at ways that you can lose weight. And so it was cutting out the carbs and counting my calories and over-exercising, you know, started running half marathons because it's what burned the most calories, and would track every single calorie into my Fitness Pal. And for years, I would just move from one extreme to another. So either I was eating really quote unquote clean and not enough, definitely not enough, and under eating and being really quote unquote good from Monday to Friday. And then I would binge at night and I would binge on the weekends. And eventually, when I got to university, the disordered eating started morphing, because then I got my Fitbit. So now I was able to calculate every single step I took, how many calories I was burning every day, how many calories I was eating, because I was plugging it all into my Fitness Pal. And so then it became obsessive, and it affected my social life, because I was anxious around food all of the time. I couldn't trust or control myself around food. So if I had like one bite of pizza, then I would eat the entire thing, and then I would start again tomorrow. And I got into the world of paleo and veganism and vegetarian, and then everything became around an obsession with being healthy. I couldn't have just regular pasta. I had to have zucchini or chickpea pasta. I would bring my own meals to family events. And what I thought I was doing in the name of quote unquote health at the time, I didn't realize was actually really unhealthy and obsessive. So long story short, I eventually hit my rock bottom, where I realized this is not a healthy way to live. I am sacrificing so much. I am not present in my life. I'm not present with my family or with my friends. I'm losing friends. I don't want to travel because I'm so nervous about gaining weight and nervous about what food I'm going to be able to eat. So it was this realization that if I didn't do something, that would be the rest of my life, even though it felt really uncomfortable to do the work to unravel my relationship with food and my body and with exercise. I knew that it would be so much more uncomfortable to wake up at 80 years old and have so much regret, because I wasted so much time obsessing over food and my body. So then I went on a multi-year recovery, where I took a lot of steps forward, a lot of steps back, a lot of learning, trial and error. And then eventually I realized that I was not the only one, and that there's so many women out there who are being a victim to diet culture and have a very unhealthy relationship with food in their bodies that are affecting their well-being. So I decided to become a health coach, to start my own business, to create a program now called the Food Freedom Academy. And I get to help women heal from the exact same thing that I struggled with for years. That was not super short, but I tried my best.
No, but you know, when someone asks you to talk about such a poignant thing in your life that, you know, sounds as though it was not just a couple of months, you know, it was years.
Yeah.
You can't just minimize that. And I would never want anybody to feel that they should minimize that to a few sentences. But I think something that is so lovely is that, you know, when you are working with your clients now, you will have such an understanding of, you know, not necessarily the specifics that they're going through, but you can understand the difficulty and the pressures that people are facing. But something I just wanted to pick up on, because this is something that I personally have struggled with, is a lot of people will say, like, their motivation for, like, getting better and stuff is thinking about, you know, their 80-year-old self and thinking, God, you know, I don't want to wake up and regret it. But my head is always just like, I don't know, I think that feels so far away that it's almost the decisions that I'm making right here in this moment, how the hell are they going to impact me? And, like, it's annoying because I can look back now and be like, you know, when I was 18, oh, I really regret that when I went on holiday, I was really ill and I didn't enjoy it. But my brain doesn't seem to be able to translate that that could also go on into the future as well.
Yeah. And I think that's because we live in a society of such short-term gratification, and we've been taught to only think about life in terms of weeks, months, maybe a couple of years.
Yes.
But what I think, I don't know if this was something that I've naturally done or this was instilled in me in my parents. My dad's an accountant, and so he would always talk about, if we're talking like financially, for example, he's always talking about retirement, even though I'm in my late 20s.
Yeah.
And so I always, every decision that I make, even now, is always from the point of view of my future self, because I want to set that version up of myself for success and for ease. And so even when I started my business, it wasn't easy at first. There was a lot of hustle. There was a lot of long nights, but I knew this is temporary and there's so much good on the other side of it. And so when it comes to the initial discomfort that you will have to go through when you decide to create a change, if it's your relationship with food, if it's breaking off a relationship that you know that's not right for you, if it means creating distance with a friendship that is no longer serving you, there's always going to be that temporary discomfort because your body and your brain don't like change, even if it's change for the better. There's this one saying that your nervous system will always choose a familiar hell over an unfamiliar heaven. And so for me, it was having this extreme clarity of what this unfamiliar heaven would look like, the kind of life I wanted to create, my values and the things that were really important to me. And for me, that was family, friendships, travel. And those things are really hard to live by when you're so consumed with obsessive thoughts about food and my body. It was taking up 95% of my brain space. So I knew if those things are important to me and those are things that will remain important to me for the rest of my life, something needs to change now.
Yeah. I think that, I mean, that quote that you've just said is absolutely beautiful. And it's so strange, isn't it, how your brain kind of, you know, if we're thinking about the familiar hell, it feels as though you would prefer to stay in an eating disorder, a disordered eating behavior, rather than go to what is unfamiliar but could potentially be amazing. But I think it is that sort of uncertainty, that unfamiliarity. You're like, oh my God, like there is endless possibility. But I guess one thing that you do know, and this is what I've always said in my own recovery, is what you're experiencing right now is not very nice. It can't get much worse. And if you do go and you embrace all these changes and actually think, I don't like this, this is actually not right for me, like I preferred it before, you can just go back there.
Yeah.
Like there's nobody saying that you can't. So I think that's a really strong thing that I keep in my mind as well. It's like the worst case, if it's shit, you know that this is an option.
Yeah. And most people are currently living in their worst case scenarios. Like if you look at, for example, I'll try to use an example that is not related to eating disorder recovery. Let's say someone is working at a desk job that they absolutely hate and they're considering starting a business. And we ask that person, what's the worst case scenario? And they say, I keep working at a job that I hate for the rest of my life. You're already at your worst case scenario. And our brains are used to going to the what if this doesn't work? What if this is a bad decision? It's not natural for us to go, what if this is the best decision I ever make? Especially in eating disorder recovery. What if this opens up my life? what if this is the best decision that I can make? Because our brains want to keep us safe. They're looking for threats. And so you're always going to go to the what if worst case scenario.
Mm. Yeah. And I think the difficulty comes in when the behaviors that you're experiencing are normalized in society. Because, you know, you mentioned a lot of things there at the start, having a Fitbit, tracking your steps, tracking your macros, tracking your nutrients, you know, bringing your own food, only eating whole grain products, or, you know, choosing vegetable alternatives or the high protein alternative. They are all things that are completely normalized and if not glorified in society. And so I think that is what is really difficult, is to recover from those things. Because, you know, you can outwardly say that an eating disorder and the behaviours are really negatively impacting your life. And people probably, I think some are praised, but maybe not to the extremities of somebody with an eating disorder. But I think when it's things, and I know we're going to come on to speak about orthorexia in a second, but particularly behaviours associated with orthorexia, I think that makes it so much harder, because those behaviours are kind of, oh, well, you know, you're just eating healthily, so that's surely fine.
Yeah, not only are they normalized, but they're encouraged. Like, I remember back then, I never thought that there was something wrong with my behaviors until years later when I looked back on it. And I remember once I went to go see my gynecologist because I lost my period for a year and a half. And she was asking me, and this was like after my recovery, and she was asking me, like, I don't want to be insensitive, but did you ever struggle with an eating disorder? And I was like, no, I never have. And I really felt that way. And I was convinced, I was like, I did have some food issues in the past, but I never had an eating disorder. And then as I started doing this work and started looking back on my past, it became so clear, like, oh, you very much had an eating disorder. But because I wasn't underweight, and because no one said anything, if anything, I got compliments. I was losing weight. You look so good. You're so healthy. You're so disciplined. Mm-hmm. I just figured, look at me. Like, I almost had this superiority complex when I would look at people eat white carbs and I would think, you don't care about your health because you're eating white carbs. And I really felt, and that's, you hear, like, there's a trend right now, which is like the crunchy mom. And it's,
oh my God, I literally saw that yesterday. And I was like, what the fuck is that?
Yeah.
Yeah. What is that? And then I Googled it. And it was like, well, one, I didn't understand how the word crunchy came into it. But
I think it's because it's a play on, because a lot of people will call people like granola. So I think maybe it has to do with like someone who's very granola, someone who's very like organic and pure. And that's where we get into the conversation of orthorexia, because that's what makes me really sad, is people are glorifying this idea of being a crunchy mom, where I'm not here to make any assumptions, but a lot of them may have orthorexia in disguise, because that's one big indication of orthorexia, is that you don't normally think that there's something wrong. You really think that you're doing things in the name of health, and no one will really call you out on it, because we live in such a diet culture society where these things are normal and encouraged.
I think, you know, there's two elements of the crunchy mum thing that really worried me, was one, using natural medication rather than, you know, clinical medication that that is needed. I think that's very damaging. And also, like you said, focusing only on organic things. And I think it's all well and good if that's the way, well, it's not all well and good, but if you want to eat that way yourself, then there's a problem. But inflicting that on your children as well, like, that is, you're bound to, you know, be developing disordered eating there. And it's just, it's so frustrating, because you said you're late 20s, which is similar age to me, and like, I was so, I thought that we were getting to a point, like, you know, my mum came from a family that were diet obsessed, and her mum was always on a diet, and but now nowadays we look at that and we're like, oh, that was obviously a diet, and that was obviously really helpful and healthy. But the crunchy mum thing is kind of, like you said, it's normalized, and people are glorifying it, which is what I think is so scary about it.
Yeah.
But I wanted to come on to orthorexia. We've obviously chatted a bit about it, but just in case people don't know, I know that it's not a diagnosable eating disorder yet, but in terms of thinking about potential signs and symptoms, what, as a food freedom coach, if you were like working with somebody and they showed particular signs, what would you be thinking? Oh, I think this is orthorexia.
Yeah, I would say that the driving definition behind it is a unhealthy obsession with being healthy, with eating healthfully or pure or organic, and to a point that it creates feelings of anxiety or stress or guilt, and it affects your everyday functioning without necessarily you recognizing it. It can affect your social well-being, your mental health, your emotional health, even your physical well-being, because sometimes you're going to cut out certain foods that can lead to nutrient deficiency. So if we're thinking about examples, it could look like overanalyzing food labels for minutes and just making sure that you're picking exactly the right product, or only eating organic and pure and foods that have no additives, and feeling a lot of stress if the option of eating quote unquote healthy is not there. So for example, for me, I would go to my sister's place and she would be making pasta, and I would have to bring my own food because just the thought of eating pasta was really triggering for me. And so there's a lot of inflexibility, rigidity, self-imposed rules around what is like righteous eating.
Yeah. I think something that's so sad about this, and I kind of, as you were speaking just then, I wanted to really reflect on it before we talked more, and that, like, the whole crunchy mum thing is worrying. And I think it's really important to say as well, like, it's not the person's fault. Like, I think with all of the sort of messaging in society, it is, you can easily get caught up in this thing that some foods are, you know, the devil, and, you know, you've got to protect yourself and all this, that and the other. And so I think it is very easy to fall into this trap of thinking that you only need to eat a certain way, which I guess then leads people to symptoms like orthorexia.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that one piece of it would definitely be bringing more awareness to it, because I didn't know what orthorexia was when I was going through it. I only found out about it a couple of years later. And because we are in the industry, we're in the field, we've heard that term before, we're very familiar with it. But when I talk to people in my life, my friends or my family, and I bring up the word orthorexia, we know anorexia, we know bulimia, we know binge eating disorder, but orthorexia, even though it was coined in 1996, it is still relatively unknown. It's not something that a lot of people talk about, because when diet culture is this really loud voice, and like you said, it's the current, it is the mainstream, it's the norm, anything that goes against it is almost seen like, I heard something about the crunchy mom on Instagram today, and it was someone who kind of is a crunchy mom and fought back and was like, you're making America sick, or you're making our kids sick, to a intuitive eating dietitian. And there's this idea that if you are promoting a healthy relationship with food and not going towards fear mongering and creating anxiety around food, then you're making people sick, and you're encouraging, like, just eat donuts and burgers all the time. Because I'm not going to say everyone, there is this propensity to think of black and white. You have to either be on or off, and there's no room for the gray. There's no room for critical thinking or opinions that differ from yours, and trying to understand someone else's point of view. So it's this idea that if you're not quote unquote clean eating, then you are promoting junk food all the time. That's super problematic, because we know that eating disorders are one of the most dangerous mental health disorders, and they cause a lot of deaths every year. And when you are promoting this fear mongering, and you grow up as a child in a family of a crunchy mom, of orthorexia, then chances of you developing anxiety and fear and perfectionism around food are so much higher. And that is going to be so much more dangerous than it is to have a bag of chips every day.
Yeah. I just think, I don't know whether I'm being too sympathetic to people, but I just, you know, the fact that people are so unbelievably scared of trusting their instincts and trusting their own hunger and fullness cues makes me so sad, because I know for one that, like, I still struggle to listen to my hunger and fullness cues, and it's something that I'm really trying to work through. But, you know, there's times where I won't have certain foods in the house because I'm scared that I'll overeat them. And that lack of trust that you have with yourself, which has been forced upon us by the media, making us think that we can't control ourselves, we're not allowed to have those things in our house, it's really damaging. And I think that's, you know, that's such a sad reality. And like you say, that's then going to be passed on to the younger generation in terms of the restriction and things like that. And I guess my question for you is, you know, if you've gone through a period, you know, in your life, or maybe it has been your whole life, of never really being able to trust yourself around certain foods, because we throw around these terms, don't we, like balanced or healthy lifestyle or moderation, and I just sit there and I'm like, what does that even mean? Mm-hmm. Because
yeah. So one thing I would say that is always helpful in terms of starting to open up your mind to new beliefs and new ways of thinking is to look at other areas of your life where you are able to trust yourself. So your body is incredibly smart. Your body is on your side. And some other areas of your life where you can acknowledge that factually is, you don't need an app to tell you when to go pee. Your body will communicate a discomfort in your bladder of like, all right, it's time to empty this out. You don't need an app to tell you when to go sleep. Your body, unless you suffer from insomnia, for example, will communicate with you in the sense of yawning, and your eyes will start to get heavy and dry. And so that is communication. All right, it's time to go sleep. Same with thirst. You will start feeling a dry mouth when your body needs water. And so there's other areas of your life, of your body's functioning, that you can trust. And so somewhere along the way, you were conditioned to believe that eating is something that you had to delegate to someone else, to something else, to an app, to a meal plan, to an expert, to an influencer. But you were born with this mechanism to know when you're hungry, to stop when you're full. So there's two sides of it. There's going to be the biological sign, which is those hunger and fullness cues, satisfaction, cravings, preferences. And then there's going to be the mental and emotional side, which is going to be the all or nothing mentality and the perfectionism and the fear and the guilt and the shame. But first, starting to get reacquainted with your body and to get familiar with what it feels like for me to be hungry. And sometimes if you come from a history of disordered eating, of skipping meals, your body may have temporarily stopped communicating with you because it kept telling you, I'm hungry, I'm hungry, I'm hungry. And instead you were like, I'm going to drink black coffee, or I'm going to have a rice cake, or I'm going to go for a walk, or I'm going to chew some gum. And so your body was trying to communicate with you, but instead of responding and honoring those hunger cues, diet culture told you to do something else because it told you that hunger is not a method of communication, but it's a weakness and it's something to hack or to ignore. And so at the beginning, when you're rebuilding trust with your body, it's like when you're rebuilding trust with a friend. If you betrayed a friend and then you were like, it is time for me to build trust again, and you just sent them a text and you were like, hey, let's be friends again, they wouldn't be like, awesome, let's do it from one text. it would take some work to rebuild that trust, and it would be showing your friend that you are trustworthy. And so your body needs that same kind of rebuilding with that trust that, all right, when I communicate with you that I'm hungry, you will listen and you will honor it. And you will provide me with consistent nourishment. You will provide me with enough nourishment so that I no longer feel like I'm constantly in survival mode, never knowing when's the next time I'm going to eat, if I'm going to have enough food. Because if I'm constantly feeling like things are scarce or they're inconsistent, then I don't want to show you those hunger signs. I'm trying to preserve your life. I'm trying to keep you safe. And sometimes if it feels like food is not consistent and food is not always present, then as a way to keep you safe and to survive, it will tune down those hunger cues, but you'll only feel them on the other extreme, which is when you're starving. And then you're so much more likely to overeat later, which perpetuates this cycle of feeling like you can't trust yourself around food. I know that was a long-winded answer, but does that make sense?
Yeah, no, it totally makes sense. And I really like the sort of analogy you use there of a friend. You know, somebody, if you've broken their trust, won't just kind of retrust you just after one incident. But my question from you, and I guess this is always my question when people talk about this, so I'm sure the listeners may be feeling the same, is if you, for example, I have been struggling with my food and body since I was 12, so that's 14 years, and I have no idea what enough means. It's another one of those words that I'm like, moderation, balance, or that enough. And I think my fear, and this is where like that trust piece comes in again, is one, I don't know how much enough is, because I can put food on my plate and then I can feel full from that, but then it's just normal for me to feel hunger or to not feel completely satiated. So how am I supposed to know what that feels like? But equally, you know, for a lot of people, if they are currently restricting, the body that they're in is not going to be the body that they are designed to be in. So naturally that might lead to weight gain. And so that's a really difficult thing to process, and to trust your body that that's not going to continue forever, I think is even more difficult. And especially in a society where not only is it glorified to eat a certain way, to exercise a certain way, but also to look a certain way. And if you're in a smaller body and you start to trust your body and that changes, I think that can then be like, oh my God, like, how are you going to prove to me that this is going to be okay?
Yeah. And you bring such an important point, which is the topic of body image healing. Because we were talking about before how your brain will go to worst case scenario. And when you've been living in a fat phobic society, which if you live anywhere, almost anywhere on the world, you do live in this kind of society that prioritizes and idolizes thinner bodies, then the worst case scenario is gaining weight, because we make that mean so much. We make it mean I've let myself go. I'm a failure. I'm less lovable. I'm less worthy. And so as long as you hold on to these beliefs that weight gain equals something, because that's when it feels so heavy, because weight gain in and of itself is a neutral circumstance. Some people, most people, see it as negative. However, for others, for example, someone who's just gone through cancer treatment, weight gain has a different meaning. It means I'm getting healthy. It means I'm recovering. It means I'm getting back to my normal body. So weight gain in and of itself is a neutral circumstance, but it's when you associate a certain thought to it, a thought that is negative, that means something about you as a person, like I have failed, I've let myself go, no one will ever love me, then of course it triggers these really heavy and strong feelings of shame, of disappointment, of regret, of guilt. And when all of our actions stem from our emotions, the way that we feel or the way that we think we will feel. So when we think about eating disorder recovery or the idea of gaining weight, if the emotions behind it are these really strong negative emotions, then we will stay in our familiar hell to avoid that. Mm-hmm. But when you can change the meaning and change the definition, so for me, one big one was it means I've let myself go. I had to stop and I had to challenge this belief. So letting myself go in my definition would mean start doing habits and live a life that doesn't feel good for me. So that might mean stop moving altogether and stop showering and stop brushing my teeth and isolate myself. That would mean letting myself go. But if gaining weight went hand in hand with allowing myself to live, to go out to eat at a restaurant, to have chocolate or cookies at home, to be less rigid, to be less flexible and actually live my life, then gaining weight had a new definition, which was I'm not letting myself go. I let myself live. And your body, I don't know if you talked about the set point weight theory on your podcast.
Oh my God, like years ago. Okay. So you can totally bring that back up.
Okay, yeah. So set point weight theory, it's not so much a theory as it is a fact that all of our bodies have a set point weight, but it's more of a set point weight range. And that range could be between 10 to 20 pounds. And I want you to think of this set point range as a thermostat. That's the range at which your body feels its best. So if you have a thermostat that's set at like 20 degrees, well, when it gets lower and colder than 20 degrees, then the heat will turn on to bring it back to 20 degrees. If it's warmer than 20 degrees, then the cold will turn on, the AC will turn on to bring it down to 20 degrees. So your set point range is going to be individual to you. And we've been conditioned to believe that just with enough willpower and discipline, we can achieve whatever weight that we can. But most of the time, what tends to happen when we get out of that set point range is that your body will trigger a bunch of mechanisms to get you back to your healthy weight. So for example, when I got below my set point weight range, when I had my eating disorder, I was cold all the time. I was hungry all the time. I was thinking about food 24/7 because my body was literally like, we need more. We need more fuel. And so we're going to think about food. We're going to send you hunger signals. And I knew deep down, I can't live this way forever. And if you're unsure if you're at your set point range or not, if you feel a lot of anxiety because you don't know how long you can maintain this lifestyle of under eating or being obsessive around food or over exercising, and it feels like it's a full-time project to maintain that weight, chances are you are below your set point weight. And if you feel, on the other hand, like you are consistently overeating, you might not be moving your body as much as you would like. And sometimes that can stem from diet backlash because you're so resistant now because you're in a rebellious mode and you're like, screw it, I'm just going to eat whatever I want. And that doesn't feel good either. Chances are you're above your set point weight. And a really good metaphor to understand this concept is, when you go to a dog park, you're going to see all types of bodies. You're going to see golden retrievers and chihuahuas and bulldogs and great Danes. And we never go and think that dog is better than that dog because this dog is smaller, or this dog must be healthier than the other one because they're a whippet or they're a great Dane instead of a bulldog. We accept and we acknowledge that dogs have body diversity. But for some reason, well, I'm not going to say for some reason, for a very specific reason, we have been conditioned to believe that there is one body type. But if you go out into the world and you see the different body types that are in our society, you will see that the bodies that you tend to see online, the six packs and the thigh gaps, that's like less than 5% of the actual population. And for me, acknowledging that my set point weight and my body type might not be exactly the body type that I thought that I would have. For example, I grew up in a world of thigh gaps. My body type is not meant to have a thigh gap unless I have an eating disorder. And so it's like, all right, choose. Do you want to sacrifice everything to have a thigh gap and still be extremely unhappy and unhealthy? Or do you want to bring acceptance into your here and now body and have the health and the happiness that you think that a certain body type is going to give you?
You know, that reminds me of the quote, it's not a dream body if it's a nightmare to maintain. And that's what I drill into my head day in, day out. Because as you were talking then, I was like, but how do you, you know, if you come to the point where you have to accept that your set point is not the point where you want your body to be, you know, and you've just summarized it so nicely. Like, you do have a choice to make. And I mean this as compassionately as possible, but you have to make that choice. Do you want to maintain this body that is causing havoc? You know, it's causing you to miss out on so much. It's causing you to have so much anxiety and all of that. Or do you want to take a chance and trust that your body knows where it should be, and that actually the only reason that you think you should look a certain way is because of what society has pushed on you? And that can then be really challenging. I'm not trying to kind of negate that at all. I think that then can be really difficult to be like, okay, I'm gonna maybe have a body that is not demonized as the perfect body in society, but there's so much more to you than just the way that you look. And what you were saying there about like different body types at a dog park and stuff. So I went to, my friend did a half marathon the other day and I went to support her. And do you know what the most wonderful thing about it was? It was the body diversity. Like, I was looking around and I was like, oh my God, these people are running 13 miles, which to people that don't do miles, it's like 21.1K. It's a long frigging way. Yeah. And, you know, so there were short people, there were tall people, there were larger bodied people, there were smaller bodied people, there were people that had loads of muscles, there were people that had hardly any muscle. Like, it was just such an indication that, you know, if you want to achieve something, it doesn't matter what your body looks like, you can do it, and that the world is filled with so many different body types. And like you said, you know, if you went onto Instagram and you put in runner, you're probably going to get a pretty specific body type come up, but actually anybody can be a runner, and the world is full of so many different types of bodies. So it's really important, I think, there as well, that when you are in this place of, you know, maybe moving to acceptance of a different body type, to really switch up your social media as well. Because that's one thing I noticed, is I follow a very small demographic of body types, and I'm really trying to shift that, because on my phone I see one thing and then I go out into society and I'm like, my God, there's so many different body types. Like, why am I not being exposed to that on my social media as well?
That's such a good point. Like, what you see on a daily basis becomes your reality, becomes like this little bubble that you form for yourself. And so you believe, well, that's the only body type. And then you see, you make assumptions about those body types as well. And one really important point to make about the body that you think that you should be at, and this goes for anything in life, whatever goal you have, whatever thing you want to achieve, whether it's a body, whether it's a career, whether it's a certain amount of money, the house, the relationship, everything that we chase in life, we don't chase for the thing itself. We chase it for how we think it's going to make us feel. And so I would say to anyone who is listening right now, if there's a certain body that you are chasing or that you are trying to maintain, I would journal on this, which is, what do I believe this thing will make me or get me or help me feel? And so when you actually write it down, some of the answers might be loved, respected, worthy, enough, happy, confident, right? Like write down all of the things that you think that body is going to make you feel. And then the next thing you should ask yourself is, A, if you're at that body currently and you're trying to maintain it, am I experiencing those things right now? Because for me, I thought that my smallest body would help me feel all those things, except we never stop and ask ourselves, am I feeling those things right now? And if you're not at that body, but maybe you have a history of yo-yo dieting and you have been in a smaller body before, did you feel those things when you were at your smallest? Or did you always feel like it was never enough? Like you got on that scale and you saw the number and you said, great, let's keep going, because I still don't feel the thing that I thought I would feel. Because feelings, how you feel about yourself, is internal work. No matter what, no external thing is going to help you feel a certain way. Because if you hated yourself to a smaller body, it's not going to switch off overnight where you're going to get on the scale and you're like, now I see a different number. Everything that I felt for the last year is now gone and I love myself. Your body image lives in your mind. It doesn't live on the scale. So asking yourself, what do I think that this certain body is going to make me feel and is going to get me? And a lot of the times you're going to start noticing that those things are actually independent of that external that you're trying to get.
I absolutely love that. Like for the listeners, when Sabrina said that initially, my jaw dropped because I was like, holy shit, that is so true. And how have I never thought about that before? But it is so true, isn't it? Like, you know, it's never, I want a smaller body because I want a smaller body. It's I want a smaller body because I want people to comment on my smaller body because that's going to make me feel loved. It's going to make me feel accepted, all of that. And then when you do get to that smaller body, you don't get that. So then you're like, oh shit, well, probably need to do a bit more. And actually, In the flip side, you know, I am currently going through recovery myself, and as part of recovery, so I used to powerlift and I've now started doing more kind of CrossFit style stuff. And one of the PTs came up to me in the gym the other day and he was like, you are looking like your training is looking amazing and you can see that your hard work is paying off. And he didn't comment on my body, but initially I was like, why did you have to say that? Like, I just took that, you know, you've gained weight. And then I thought about it and I was like, well, yeah, okay, maybe I have. But that's allowing me now to really like push myself to achieve new goals, to feel so good about myself. And I don't feel like I'm going into the gym anymore to be like, I need to be the smallest body. It's like, how strong can I make this body? And even then, it's, you know, his comment to me was really nice. But to hit PBs myself, you know, that internal reward of, oh my God, I just hit a PB and stuff like that. I'm feeling the more and more that I go on in recovery, it's less about that gratification or the comments from other people. And it's more about me and what I can achieve and realizing, oh my God, I don't feel like I'm going to die whilst I'm doing this because I've just got no energy left.
Yeah. Oh my God, that's amazing. And you hit on a really good point, which is whenever, especially if you're going through recovery or you're working on healing your body image and your relationship with food, whenever you feel a negative emotion, whether it's from a comment that someone makes or a picture that you see or anything that might be triggering for you, an emotion is simply a vibration in your body. And a lot of the times it is triggered by a thought that you're having. And so become present to the negative emotion and start labeling it. Okay, what did I feel when I heard that comment? Did I feel stressed? Did I feel ashamed? Did I feel guilty? Like, what did I feel? And then the next thing is, all right, what association, what meaning, what thought did I have that made me feel this way? So for you, for example, when you got that comment of you're looking great and you felt this initial negative emotion, what thought do you think triggered that?
my eating disorder. Is that what you mean for me to say? Or
so if we were to dig a little bit deeper, what thought did you have about yourself that created this negative emotion?
Well, I thought that I'd gained weight and that was a bad thing, which I thought is what he was picking up on.
Okay, so there, right there, I gained weight. If we go back to like when we were talking about how that's a neutral circumstance, what thought was underneath it? If you gained weight, what did you make it mean?
That I was gross. Or that that was a bad thing.
And why is it a bad thing?
Because I've been told it's a bad thing.
Mm-hmm.
And that it's unattractive and not what people desire, whereas the smaller body is what people desire.
Okay. And the next thing, and this is kind of the process that I take my clients through. So, and if you want me to stop you at any point, please.
No.
But this is a really important process, because challenging your beliefs is how we really start restructuring how our brain works. And so I would then ask you, why do you have a body?
A weird question. I guess to hold myself together, to allow me to live life and do things so that it can all function as one.
Mm-hmm. So would saying that it's a vehicle for you to experience life, is that a good way to summarize that?
Yeah. Much nicer than I just...
And notice how in your definition, your intellectual definition, it didn't include I have a body to please others or I have a body to look good. And so logically, intellectually, you know, this is when I know what I should do, but I'm not doing it. You know that your body is there to experience life. Subconsciously, deep down, there's this belief that you have a body to please others. And so your subconscious thoughts will pop up in the shape of feelings. And so when that comes up for you, noticing that, what am I thinking right now? Okay, I'm thinking that if I gain weight, then I'm gross. People won't like me. People won't think I'm attractive. Well, that's when you can go and get to the deep-rooted belief and think, okay, well, I don't have a body to be attractive. I don't have a body to please others. My body is there to help me experience life. And I can actually experience so much more life now because look, I'm getting stronger. I'm doing more. I'm going out more. So it's serving its function right now.
I think what's really difficult is that there's kind of, I feel for me anyway, and obviously this isn't a therapy session, so I don't need to go into a deep, but it's, I think that my view of myself and my self-esteem is so low that my purpose in life is to please others. And so, yes, I have a body to kind of, for me to experience life, but I haven't yet got to a point where I don't think that my purpose is like to allow others to experience life. And I guess that doesn't necessarily mean that my body has to look a certain way, but because of that sort of people pleaser nature, it's, and also this is a really interesting thing, and this is completely tangential, but I'm going through an ADHD diagnosis at the moment, and one of those things is kind of, I for so long just kind of fit whatever in the social situation, I just kind of do whatever I think that the other person is doing that's deemed socially acceptable for people to like me. And I think that that's another element that's playing into my body image, and that I've been told that there's this particular ideal, and in order for people to like me I have to meet that. And so kind of coming to that point, and, you know, that is a brilliant kind of description, what you said there, and such a good thing to aim towards, and like your body is there for you to experience things. But I think it's shifting that narrative, isn't it, of my body is here for me and it's not something for other people. Mm-hmm. And I think that comes, that's part of the recovery journey, isn't it, is knowing that it's your life to live and that what you're doing should be to make you happy. And obviously with that, like, you can make other people happy as well, but ultimately you're the only person that's going to be here for the whole of your life, realistically, if we're being morbid. So really making sure that you're happy and doing the things that you want to do is really important.
Yeah, and that's such a good point, and thank you for sharing that and being so open about it, because a big reason why we hang on to this body is because we've formed and shaped our identity into it. And one big work that I do with my clients is, all right, well, if your life goal is no longer to morph yourself into a certain version of yourself, and it's no longer to look a certain way or to lose the weight, then how can we build our self-esteem outside of that? Because if your only source of self-esteem is from the way that your body looks, then that connection is strong, and it's really hard to build outside of that. So a little journaling that you could do, or all of your listeners could do, is one thing that I make my clients do right from week one is every day at the end of the day, I want you to write down three things that you love about yourself. And when I first started doing that with my clients, a lot of them had a hard time even coming up with three. And if that's the case, that is such a good indication that this is an exercise that you need to do over and over again and make your brain hurt to look for those things, because your body, your brain is not used to looking for those things because it's so attached to your body. And so when you start looking for those things outside of your body and you're like, okay, I'm going to set the bar low. I like that I wake up at the same time every day and that I don't have to hit the snooze button, like set the bar so low. You just want to get that brain muscle going, looking in that new different direction.
Yeah, and I 100% did not smirk then when you said if you can't think of three things, yeah, that's a good exercise. Yeah, I currently do the three good things that have happened today, because the three things I love or like about myself is a little more challenging. But yeah, I think that is a great idea, and going further than your body or the way that you eat or the way that you do, you know, certain things is really important. But Sabrina, it's honestly, it's been such a pleasure, and thank you so much. You've given so much insight there. It's just amazing. And I really appreciate as well you guiding me through that. I think that'd be really useful for listeners, because often I think our thoughts, you know, I will always have an instinctive thought of like, that's bad, but then I'll never question why. And so when you started then unpicking it with me, you could probably tell how difficult I was finding that, because it's not something that I've tried. So yeah, that was really amazing, and definitely to the listeners, just try that out at home, because you might struggle as much as I did.
Yeah, and that's the thing, is when you're noticing that this is hard for your brain, that's where you want to stick to it. You want to stick on it, because that's when you're rewiring your neural pathways and you're trying to find a new way to think, your brain is going to be like, I don't want to do this. This is too hard. I don't know. And stick to it. And the more that you do it, the easier it's going to get. So I'm going to challenge you to do that for the next week, is instead of writing, or you can do on top of writing three good things, three things that you appreciate. And we're not going to say love, because that might be a little strong at the beginning, but three things that you appreciate about yourself. And it should be new things every day. And you're going to see that your brain is going to start working during the day to find new things. And you're going to be like, whoa, okay, I didn't realize that was there, but I do appreciate that about myself. And see how that feels.
Yeah. Okay. I will do that. And then I will share it with you.
Amazing.
To prove that I have done it. So, I mean, you've given so much information, which has been fantastic, and I'm sure people will want to kind of connect with you to find out more. So where can people go to find out more about you?
Yeah, so I have my own podcast, which they can listen to. It's called Live Unrestricted, where I do a lot of this stuff. I love coaching people through it. I love having guests. And I do solo episodes as well. And then you can find me on Instagram at sabrina.magna.health. And if you did listen to this episode, send me a DM. I answer all my DMs personally, so I would love to know what your biggest takeaways were.
Amazing. Thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure. Lovely to chat to you.
Thank you so much for having me. Have an awesome day.
If you enjoyed listening today, you won't want to miss next week's episode, so be sure to subscribe. Eating disorders are crippling illnesses, but with the right support, they can be recovered from. We really hope you enjoyed this episode, but if you require more support right now, please look into charities such as First Steps and Beat for support, or talk to someone you trust.